Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a new episode of Well Played. And today I have with me the CEO of Obsidian Entertainment. His name is Fergus Urquhart, and I'm very happy that he's on the show. Hello, Fergus.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, good. How are you?
Doing well.
Great. I'm going to give just a brief overview of what Obsidian is for the people who might not be too familiar with the company. You were founded in 2003. Your first game that you made was Knights of the Old Republic Part 2, which came out in 2004. You then went on to do Neverwinter Nights 2, Alpha Protocol, Fallout New Vegas, Dungeon Siege 3, the South Park RPG, The Stick of Truth, and most recently Pillars of Eternity in 2015, and Tyranny last year. And let's start off by the most recent development, obviously. Namely, a couple of weeks ago, you launched the crowdfunding campaign for Pillars of Eternity 2, which is called Deadfire. And as of right now, with 16 more days to go, you're at, I think, $2.3 million raised. Is that correct?
Yep, that's we're right about there.
Okay, so you must be a very happy camper right now.
No, it's really good. I mean, it's great to see the response, and it's cool to see sort of this new paradigm of sort of not just crowdfunding, but the crowd investment, you know, because it's kind of a cool thing to see sort of that we have this sort of other option now to go and get our products funded.
When you compare the numbers right now to what you raised with Pillars of Eternity, the first part, which raised about $4 million, do you expect to land in the same kind of ballpark? Was that where you wanted to go?
Well, you know, I mean, of course, you always hope like we could, you know, I mean, heck, we could probably even hope that we would do more. But I think that the sort of the reality is sort of crowdfunding is a bit different in 2017 than it was in 2012. And sort of backers are more discerning and they want to make sure that they really feel really good about something. And so that's really where the investment part of sort of the platform we're on right now, FIG, is helping out. And so sort of our estimates right now is, you know, I think we'll, you know, we'll probably get somewhere in the 3.5 to 4 million, but hopefully we'll even get more. So we're going to get pretty close, but that's not just with backers, but it's going to be with the investors as well.
Can you walk me through really quick on how that investing part on FIG works for the people who might not even know about that, especially in Germany?
Yeah, sure. So how it kind of works with FIG is that sort of, you know, for each project that FIG puts up for investment, the developer sort of offers an investment return, you know, sort of like if you're investing, I don't know, in a real estate or you know, buying stock or something like that. I mean, I guess it's a little different than stock. It's more like investing in real estate. And so what it is you're in essence, you're buying, you know, a share based upon a certain return. And kind of what we put up there is to say that, you know, at a certain return of Pillars of Eternity, that, you know, we'll pay 13%. Of the money, you know, give you a 13% return on your money. And then after that, you actually get a tail for quite a while after the game is coming out. You know, and depending upon how the game does, you know, people could, you know, can do better than the 13%. And so that's, you know, that's kind of how it works. And kind of, you know, where we came up with that 13% is Pillar, you know, Deadfire is pretty far along. And so we're going to be getting the money in, you know, at the end of February, March. We're shipping next March. So we were looking at it. We were trying to give people the idea of like how much money they would get for us holding their money for, you know, 12, 13, 14 months.
You just mentioned that you're pretty far ahead in the development, obviously, with an early 2018 release date that you set, and you now said March. So how much work was actually done before you involved the backers on Kickstarter? I mean, would that game, even without the Kickstarter campaign or the FIG campaign as it is now, would it have been released anyway? Is it already in that? I mean, I assume it's already in the alpha kind of stage, isn't it?
Well, we're in production. So we were looking at sort of a little bit more than a 2-year development. And so what that meant is, you know, a certain amount of pre-production, about 6 to 8 months of pre-production. And then we went into production, you know, sort of like late last year. And so now we're getting through our production milestones. And then we're going to be alpha late summer, which then gives us about 5-6 months to go from alpha, which means the game kind of has all the stuff in it at that point, to, you know, a polished final game. So, So, you know, so in essence, what we've done is we've done about a year of work before we actually offered it up. But the game, we really do need the funding to be able to finish the game, because we want to make sure that the sequel is, you know, is a sequel that everybody is really happy with. And it's something that our backers feel we just didn't like. I don't know if that's the right term, that we didn't just make it easy for ourselves. That we're really pushing the engine from the standpoint of the graphics, and there's a whole new scheduling system where people walk around and they have, you know, they go home, they go to bars, the weather, a huge dynamic weather system. So we really wanted to really make the sequel awesome, and that meant involving our backers in helping us do that.
Mm-hmm. Comparing the two campaigns, what I found rather interesting was that with the first Pillars of Eternity, a lot of the stretch goals that you set were content related. And now I look at the stretch goal for Pillars of Eternity 2, and yes, there's content related stuff on there, but right. There's also a lot of more of like the technical side of things, yeah. Like translations, there's the UI customization, that type of stuff. Was that something that you learned in the first Pillars of Eternity, that you maybe, I don't know, bloated the game a wee bit by all these stretch goals?
I think we learned a lot, and you know, and I think the other thing is that, you know, some of the stuff we can't offer again because, you know, some of the stretch goals in Eternity 1 were for races and classes. Well, we already have those races and classes, and we also didn't want to bloat the game with even more races and classes, because you start getting into this thing in an RPG where they're like, if there's 17 classes, it starts to like, are they really that different from them, you know, each other anymore? And do you even know what class to pick? And so we've just tried to do things that are really interesting. Josh and the team came up with this idea of multiclassing and subclassing. And I think that's, you know, that's going to make the characters really interesting. So you kind of get this flavor of tuning your class without this idea of us like creating, like I said, 17 different classes. And so, no, I mean, it was a lot of learning, and it was also, and it really was that idea of, you know, we've certainly, you know, we sort of like some of the stuff we could have offered if this was the first time around, we can't offer anymore because we've already done it.
All right. Looking back at where you came from with Pillars of Eternity back in 2012, when you launched the Kickstarter campaign back then in September, at that point, I think Obsidian was in a pretty rough stretch, right? I mean, you had a big RPG that you developed for the Xbox One console canceled by Microsoft. Then you had the South Park RPG, where your publisher at that time, THQ, was spiraling towards bankruptcy. I think you even had to lay off some staff in that year. So how much of a lifeline for you guys was Pillars of Eternity?
Well, I mean, it was amazing in so many different ways. I mean, it was this relief to be able to, obviously it's the relief, you know, I'm the guy that runs the business and I worry about, you know, are we going to be able to pay everybody? And so that's a very personal thing for me, but it's different than making games, you know, in certain ways. And so, I mean, obviously it was the personal relief for me, but then it was this, now we get to do something that we really want to, and people believe in us, and not only do they believe in us, but, you know, now we're going to get to make something that we now can keep on making for as long as we want to make it. It's something we own, and it's something that, it's something that we can do all sorts of new things with. And I think that was sort of those twofold things of, yes, absolutely helped the studio, but it also kind of like just, you know, there's a new breath of life into Obsidian, in that we're now going to be able to put our, you know, our heart and soul into something that we can keep on doing it. It's, you know, it's like Lucas with Star Wars. And so, I mean, in a very minor way, of course, but, you know, Lucas owned Star Wars. And so he could keep on living in that world. And sometimes with us, it's hard to sometimes jump completely in all the time when we know we're going to have to jump out. And so it was just an amazing, it was just an amazing thing to happen to us.
Touching upon that, I read in an interview you had with Games Industry Biz, where you said, if you were making Knights of the Old Republic 3, and you're obviously not, it was just hypothetically speaking, and it's going to cost $50 million, and you are going to make $7.5 million on milestones, and then maybe make another $5 million in royalties, that would be pretty good for an independent developer on a project, but you could make more profit from two Pillars of Eternities than one of those games. And on top of that, you own the franchise.
Yep.
Is the model or the business relation between publisher and independent developer really that broken at the moment?
No. Well, I think the thing is I'm also, you know, we all try to that was sort of an apples to oranges comparison in certain ways. I mean, so my statement is actually correct. I mean, that's kind of the numbers. But I think the other thing to think of is it's the issue with making big AAA products like Mass and Andromeda or Origins or Coder 3 or something like that is just a huge investment on a publisher's part. And not every huge investment that they make pays off. And so I intellectually absolutely understand. I mean, they have to make sure that when something is successful, that they can make as much money off of it. Because when you have something like a KOTOR 3, and let's say that the development budget, is 50 to 100 million and they're going to spend 50 million on marketing, and then it's going to be 10 million units is $100 million to put on the shelf. I mean, that's an immense amount of money. And so the publisher has to depend upon recouping it. And they're the ones investing that $200-300 million. So it's not so much that it's broken. It is really the stark realities of AAA console product.
I mentioned that earlier, you had that Xbox One game, that RPG called Stormlands, canceled. And you recently said, again, touching upon that relationship between publisher and independent developer, that you lacked an advocate for that game, an internal advocate at Microsoft's part. And on the one hand, from an outside perspective, it sounds very plausible that you need that type of advocate. On the other hand, one would assume that the games industry business, being that multi-million, billion-dollar kind of industry that it is right now, would focus on the quality of the games and not just, having an advocate inside. How big would you say is that whole advocacy thing in regard to getting your games published?
I mean, I think it's what you're dealing with. I mean, it's ultimately you're dealing, with humans, right? And humans have things that they're worried about and things that they're not worried about. And so a lot of the advocacy and the reality of making big games as well is just that, they go through challenges and they have problems and you need to be able to manage through all those problems. Not every single game that you've seen on the shelf that was huge at some point had a really bad moment. And that's where the advocacy is important. I mean, that is where it matters that there is someone there that is on the developer side and believes in the developer and believes in the product and believes in the quality and can help manage those situations. Because again, people are human. And when you're put under that much pressure about, is this game going to be good? Is it going to not? And people feel their careers are on the line and are they going to get fired and all this kind of stuff. It's just an incredibly complicated, stressful situation.
When you say that from your perspective you lack this advocate that really pushed for your game inside of Microsoft, what could you speculate what Microsoft would probably say, give as a reason for the cancellation of the game? Did they have kind of like some stuff that they didn't like, or was it really that you were on the kind of like of the back burner of their heads all the time because there was no one just pushing you into the spotlight?
Well, I think, one of the challenges is that it's RPGs are really big and they're kind of scary. I mean, even for the guys that make them on a day-to-day basis, we think they're big and scary. And so for the people that don't do them every day, they're even scarier. And, and we totally understand that. And that is, the sort of the thing that we manage and we talk to to publishers about all the time. I mean, publishers love and want to make role-playing games because they see how successful they can be. Every game that Obsidian has released has made money, which is a pretty good track record. But it's hard, it's one of those things where, when it's something big and that you don't understand exactly on how it's going to be successful and how this is going to work and how that's going to work and that's a tough call, right? And so I think that's one of the big challenges we have in general, when we're talking to publishers and talking internally, is just the dealing with, like, how do you deal with it? How do you understand, like, if an RPG is going to be good? It's funny, you could talk to a lot of people who make RPGs. I've talked to Ray and Greg about this all the time. And it is also this reality of an RPG, and maybe we'll solve this at some point, but an RPG is just this thing where it kind of all comes together at the end. So it's just this ride of having to do a lot of trust and knowing that 6 months before it's done, it's going to be good. But before that, it's really tough because it's about the story and it's about the characters and it's about how it all works together with the systems. It's not about this static level of like Overwatch or TF2 in which, you know, you can get in with a few characters and get some of the gameplay and you can start feeling how good it is. It's really hard to start getting a good feeling for an RPG until pretty late in development.
Is that true for all types of RPGs? I mean, even with the old school type of RPG that you're now making with Pillars of Eternity and Tyranny, is that true for these type of games as well?
No, I think so, because it's sort of like, you know, it's sort of this thing of like, you don't have the story completely in and working. All the companions are not doing all of their talking. The quests are not all exactly, and all the item balances and all the in, all the quest balances and always in. So it's funny how there, it's, an RPG is so much, it is a sum of its parts. And when some of those parts, that seems sort of bad to say it that way, but when some of those parts aren't right yet, it's hard to get that sense of like, is it good yet?
How much would you say in retrospect, did a certain reputation that Obsidian acquired, at least from a player's perspective, for maybe chewing off a bit more sometimes that they could chew with like Fallout New Vegas, for instance, or with Alpha Protocol, or even going back to Knights of the Old Republic 2, where you had to cut a lot of content, which was only years later restored by a content patch. So how much did that reputation of making very ambitious but sometimes buggy games hurt you when you're dealing with publishers, or wasn't that an issue at all?
You know, I don't think that was an issue, and I think we've done a really good job over the last years to change that reputation. I think that like our games that have come out in, mm-hmm. you know, you're talking now probably, you know, really since, you know, probably, I'm trying to think of the math in my head, probably over the last 6 years, which is a pretty good track record now of games that have come out and you know, and not only have they come out, I mean, and even if there were, you know, some things that were wrong with them, we get things fixed quickly, and we continue to support them. I think I'm really proud of what we've done with Pillars of Eternity, in that not only did we release the expansions and kind of fulfill all our promises that we kind of gave to our backers, but we've continued to refine that game, you know, over the years, you know, over the almost 2 years that it's since it's come out. And, you know, and you can even see it. It's really interesting when I go up online and I kind of read the forums and talk to people, and, you know, not talk to people, but just reading their comments about how, like, people really recognize that. They see that, you know, where Pillars is now is that it was great when it came out, and we've just worked to make it even better.
Going just a wee bit deeper on that, I read in one of the interviews that you've given over last couple of years that at some point you were kind of saying, and you were getting the company together and you were saying, we are not going to make buggy games again.
Right.
How does that happen? I mean, obviously you can say that, but obviously you weren't going into these games with the saying, oh, let's make a buggy game. So what exactly do you have to change in your whole culture and the way you're making games to get to the point where you are now?
Well, it's a lot of things. I mean, part of it is just to, I mean, part of it really is to just say it, you know, is to say, this is not acceptable. Like this, like, and all of the excuses we may have about why it happened, I get them, like, I understand them, logical, doesn't matter. Like, we need to start with the concept that we are going to make games that are as bug-free as possible. Now, how we then back it up is, you know, one is we fight for more testing on our games when working with a publisher. You know, we've hired more testers. We're working with an outside testing group that's doing great work from us. He was the guy who's running this outside testing group. His name is Jeremy Barnes. He was actually the head of QA at Interplay when we were doing a lot of the role playing games. So his team actually even has that knowledge. So then on top of that, you know, what we've done is it probably looks a lot like accounting, and maybe probably a lot of boring to people when they think of games as sort of this creative thing that we do. But we have charts and we have burn downs and we have accelerations and velocities of bugs and constant questions. And when a game is sort of in the last 4 months, I have an email that comes in my inbox every morning that shows me this is the status of the bugs and where they all are and what we're doing with them. And that's, you know, and that me having that information means that everybody else has that information. Me having that information and them knowing that I'm going to ask them about it makes people focus on it more. And so, you know, so I think we really made it a priority.
Going a bit further back in time, when you made Fallout New Vegas, which is probably responsible for a lot of these Obsidian are making buggy games type of prejudices, so to speak, that still linger on today. And even you personally said that with Fallout New Vegas, you bit off a little more than you could chew. Looking back at that game in particular, if you got to do a do-over, what would you do with Fallout New Vegas? Would you cut some content? Would you develop it in a totally different way? Or would you do it all over again?
Well, for me, I just sort of embrace the past, right? And I just go, look, it's what we did. And it's a game that everybody loves, and, you know, 10 to 15 million people have bought it. And that's just my guess. I don't actually know the real numbers. And people compliment us every day on it. And so I'm not going to change it. Like, of course, what we do, though, and I don't want anybody to take from that to say then that means I'm just flipping about bugs and stuff like that. Not at all. It's you need those situations to kick yourself in the ass and say, okay, how do we do this better the next time? And that's what we do as a studio. And I think it can be seen in our games, is every time we do another game, we do it better. You know, it's a bit more polished. It's less buggy. We dive deeper into what it means to be an RPG in them. And so that's how we take it. So that's why I wouldn't change it. I mean, of course, I mean, like, you know, I mean, I would love to, you know, go back in time and fix all the things in my life and ask that girl out that I should have asked out in high school. But I try to live in the real world and say, okay, it's what happened. It was great. But what we needed to learn something from it. And we try to learn that stuff every day.
Fair enough. I recently had a discussion on Fallout New Vegas, because I'm one of the people who love it as well, and I still think it's the best Fallout, maybe in competition with Fallout 2, which you also, I think you were the lead designer of Fallout 2, right?
I was, yeah.
Yeah. But I recently had a discussion with a couple of people, and that comes up kind of like every time I talk with more than, you know, my friends about Fallout New Vegas. There's always someone or two people who say, oh, I've heard it was great, but I never really gotten into it. And what I usually tell them is you have to play it twice. It's one of these games where you really have to play it twice to appreciate everything that's in there. And a lot of the things that the game does really, really good, like offering not just one or two solutions to quests, but sometimes five or six, and they sometimes even, you know, intertwine with other quests, mm-hmm. and all that type of stuff that you totally miss from, or in large part, or at least in my part, that I missed on the first playthrough, and where I'm more concentrated on the stuff that didn't work. Would you say that's kind of like a fair way of looking at it? That there was just, you know, maybe back then open world games weren't at that stage where one had learned a lot of how they worked on a first playthrough. You know what I mean?
I think I know what you mean. I think the way I look at it, you know, if I would have any criticism of us, I mean, I think sometimes it's the situation, and I think that it goes across our games, but, you know, and maybe in Fallout New Vegas is maybe a good example of it. You know, what we're really good about setting up all of these possibilities and sort of in some cases we reinforce that, you know, we'll make sure that the game reacts to what you did and how you're playing the game. And so it feels like to the player, or feel like to you, that, oh, well, that's just how the game works. And then you don't really recognize, no, the game actually, it reacted to what you were doing. And then you play it again, you're like, well, it's now reacting a completely different way. And potentially, I think the thing is sometimes for us is maybe we're doing that too subtly. Now, you don't want to hit the person over the head with it. But in a lot of ways, you want them to understand that there is this, that really is, there is a reaction, and that your choices and what you're doing is very meaningful. And some of that is you somehow have to give them the glimpse of what would have happened so they understand that it actually mattered. But if you don't, but sometimes if you don't want, like I said, you can do that too subtly and it's missed. But if you look, you hit them over the head with it, then it feels contrived. So it's really a balance, and it's just something that we work on, you know, we work on every day to kind of figure out how to do it the best way.
How big was it for you personally to get to make another Fallout game after doing, you know, being involved with Fallout 1 and Fallout 2 at Interplay and then forming your own studio, working on then Star Wars, then Neverwinter Nights, so the D&D license. And then at some point, Bethesda must have come to you and said, guys, would you like to make a new Fallout? I mean, what was that for you? Was it kind of like... even though you weren't that involved in the actual development of the game, but was it kind of like a my baby's back kind of feeling?
No, totally. I mean, I love Fallout. I mean, I was so blessed and so lucky to be able to work on the original Fallout. What was interesting is that when I was first put in charge of the RPG division, and funny, I was just me and Tim and Leonard were just chatting about sort of those early days just right before this interview. And we were, you know, when I was put in charge of the RPG division, Fallout actually was not in the RPG division because the RPG division at the time was mostly, it was mostly all just Dungeons and Dragons stuff. It was actually sometimes called the TSR division way back then in 1996. And so it was interesting. And me and Tim had been friends because I was his lead tester on a game in 1992, I can't remember one of those years. And so we got together and, you know, I was part of his gaming group and when I was back from college and stuff like that. And so, so we were friends and, you know, and we were talking about it and I was running the division and talking to him and it was just like one conversation in his office about like, you know, what about if we just, it sounds like you guys need some help about just sort of like on the staffing and all that kind of stuff. Why don't we just, I talked to Fargo and we bring Fallout into the RPG division. And then I just start solving, you know, those things for you. And Tim was like, yeah, that sounds good. And so that's what happened. So it's interesting. Like it was not originally the plan that I would be involved in Fallout, but it sort of happened. And that's why I'm very thankful. And so, no, you're right. You know, when it coming Fallout New Vegas coming back, it is an amazing thing. It's the Fallout 3 that we wanted, you know, that we were always hoping to be able to make and never got to at Black Isle. So no, you're right. You're right. It was awesome to get to do it.
Mentioning the Fallout 3 that you never got to make, there's obviously Van Buren, the cancelled Fallout project that Interplay started, or you guys started to develop an Interplay, and that was later cancelled, named after U.S. president, because all the games, or was it just an RPG division thing that all the games were named after U.S. presidents?
It was only in Black Isle, so yeah, so we just basically used our code names were U.S. presidents.
And nowadays you have code names for U.S. states, right?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
I wanted aircraft carriers, but I got over it.
So Polaris of Eternity 2 was actually Project Louisiana, right?
Pillars of Eternity 2 is Louisiana. Yes, exactly.
So that again led to some people, especially when you made the first teaser announcement on your website, that led some people, because it was codenamed Louisiana, some people kind of figured, oh, I think they are going to make a Fallout New Orleans, which sounds really awesome, I have to admit, as a concept. But were you at any stage close to doing another Fallout, or is that all kind of like the conjecture that's out there?
You know, we're still buddies with the guys at Bethesda and we talk all the time and we always let them know that, you know, whenever, you know, it looks like the planets can align again, we'd love to make another Fallout. But we've never, you know, other than me expressing that, we've never had any deeper conversations about us doing another Fallout.
So you're probably going to be watchful of the states you pick for the next couple of games and do like Project Arkansas or something that doesn't have a big city in there.
Exactly. Yep.
There's kind of like this other thing about New Vegas that I just want to briefly touch upon. And you're probably sick of hearing that question. But the whole thing with you didn't get the bonus or the royalties because you only had a Metacritic score of 84 instead of an 85, which is still circling around wildly in the internet. And a lot of people use that to do kind of like the paint the publisher a bad way, and the poor, you know, little developer who doesn't get his money because of 1% on Metacritic, and who cares about Metacritic anyway, and all that spiel. Right. What's your perspective looking back on that thing? Did it get maybe blown out of proportion, or is that still something that irks you a little bit?
Well, you know, I think the thing, I mean, I mean, it doesn't really irk me. Partly because when we signed the contract, we actually didn't even ask for the bonus language in the contract, right? So that was something that Bethesda had put in there, and that's fine. I mean, you know, we're pretty pragmatic about bonuses and things like that that are tied to things that are in contracts. And so there was, I mean, if we had gotten the 85, that's awesome, but we knew there's only so much control we have over our Metacritic score. And so we just didn't worry about it. And then when we didn't get it, we didn't get it. Of course, you know, I can't say that it's not frustrating, but that was the agreement between us and Bethesda, and it said 85 and it wasn't 85. And so, you know, that's what it is. I guess I just don't put much stock. I don't worry about it. I don't think about it every day. I still talk to the guys at Bethesda all the time. You know, we're friends. And so, yeah, I don't, that's how I look at it. It's in the past, and, you know, we've moved on.
Another game that you also published in 2010 was your spy RPG Alpha Protocol, which I think is a very, very curious game and one of the more interesting games, or most interesting games of these type of years for me, because I really, really liked it. And a lot of the people, especially in the press, they really slammed it when it was released. What happened with Alpha Protocol? Because on the one hand, that's why I find it so interesting. On the one hand, I can totally understand the people who say it wasn't particularly good. And I'm just sitting there and say, I get where you're coming from. I totally understand your arguments, but I still love it.
it's the poor game that was misunderstood. My perspective is this. When I look back at Alpha Protocol, it took us a really long time to kind of figure out what it is that we wanted to do with it. And this is where I also can give a lot of credit, not just to the team, but to Chris Avalon for sort of really figuring out what it is that we wanted to accomplish with it. And that's where he really, really pushed on sort of like how we can handle all of these sort of, how do I put it? How we can handle all of this choice and all the different ramifications of that choice, and how to put that into sort of a mission-based spy RPG. And that is really what made Alpha Protocol awesome. There's the other aspects of it. It was sort of our first game like that that we'd done from scratch. Like I said, it took a long time for us to figure out exactly what we were going to do. That's probably what I would say. That's how I feel about it in the end. I think if we had gotten our act together a lot faster and figured out what we're going to do, I think it would be a game that would be less misunderstood.
I remember one of the things when I first read about Alpha Protocol being in development and being a spy RPG, there were kind of like two reactions I had. One was, oh, great, a spy RPG. That's never been done before in that sense. And my next reaction was kind of like, who is supposed to buy that game?
Yeah, who was our demographic?
I really wonder. I mean, I guess, and even judging from your reaction, that was kind of like something you guys talked about a lot, right?
Well, we did. I don't know. Sometimes there's a certain amount of making games. You know, we do think about the player and the demographic and all that kind of stuff. But there's a part of us, like, we're just gamers and we make games. And, you know, even going back, we've been talking a lot about Fallout and using Fallout as an example of, like, people like, well, how did you know it was going to be successful? And we're like, we didn't know. Like, we're just like, hey, this would be cool. Let's make this. It's the kind of game that we would like to play and we would like to make. And it's something we just think is cool. And it seems to be, you know, kind of involved in a world, you know, where it involved in a genre that people like with, you know, the Road Warrior and stuff like that. So that's, you know, that's a certain part of it, you know, and sometimes when you do that, it works out well. And sometimes when you don't, it doesn't hit the mark exactly, you know, and I think that's maybe what happened with Alpha Protocol a bit.
Alpha Protocol wasn't the only game that you developed for Sega, which was the publisher on Alpha Protocol, because you also had, and that I find very interesting, you had an RPG set in the Alien universe from the Alien movies that was unfortunately cancelled in 2009. Can you talk a wee bit more about that game? I think it was it called Crucible or something like
right.
that?
It was called Aliens Crucible. And I don't know, this is probably off color and I don't know if the joke will transfer, but there was actually at one point in time we were trying to come up with names, and a name that was proposed to us that we weren't exactly sure how to go back and explain why it couldn't be the name of the game. But we were proposed that it should be called Battle of the Queens because there was two queen aliens in it. And we got the email and we were like, is someone just making a joke? Like, are they being funny? And then, no, they were serious. And then it was a very awkward conversation to go like, why Battle of the Queens might not be the best name for the game. But we got beyond that, and, you know, Crucible ended up being the name. If you want to picture what Aliens was, it was Mass Effect in the aliens world, with probably more sort of tactical control of your companions. You could have your companions do more stuff, and of course it was having aliens, so it was more sort of kind of even closer up combat, because you know we wanted the aliens in your face. You know, we had a thing where, you know, the aliens could grab you, and there was, you know, obviously a mini game to get away from the alien. That's really, if I could just draw the picture in your head, that's what it was. It was really sort of a Mass Effect style game put in the Aliens universe.
No, I'm really sad that I never get to play. Because that does sound good. What happened with it? Why, can you elaborate a little bit on why that was canceled? And also thinking, I mean, if I just be, you know, part of the audience here and a gamer, I would kind of say, my God, why did they cancel that when they put so much time and money into Colonial Marines?
And it's interesting. I think there's actually, this was not put up by us, but if you're interested in it, there's actually, I think there's a YouTube video that shows some of the gameplay. The gameplay is a little bit old from kind of when we finally finished it. I'm not sure who released it, but someone released it. And so you can actually see kind of some of what we had done. I hate to say, it sounds like I'm a broken record as it relates to there's challenges in development. There were some hard things that had to get solved in Aliens. One of the hard things was that aliens are hard. So that sounds strange, but if you picture, we can make things feel pretty lifelike in games as to how they animate and move around in a world. But now picture sort of an installation on an alien planet in which you're kind of going through, you're going through airlocks. And so you have these corridors and you have hatches and all that kind of stuff. Now picture, take a 20 foot long quadruped alien. How do you get that thing to run around in that environment in a way that doesn't look like, just to use the word, look like crap? And so that was hard, and we were working towards it. I think one of our other challenges, we were building also an engine at the same time as we were building the game, and that's always kind of dangerous. And so that was kind of plagued, like the developers couldn't move forward because we were still building the technology behind it. So that was a challenge. And really the saddest thing about that game, it got canceled literally as it was all coming together. And I understand, you know, why Sega made the decision, and they had only so much money in development money that they could put into other games in the following year. And I understand all that kind of, but it was just sad because it literally, like, we'd come up with a new sort of, a world editing system. You could think kind of GEC and things like that. And we were now building levels quickly using that. Aliens were looking better. The characters looked really good. The combat was feeling good. So it was just kind of sad. And that we kind of got to that point, and that's kind of when it all went away.
But is that kind of like reality, at least in these times, before the Pillars of Eternities and before the Kickstarter and before the crowdfunding, that as an independent developer, your babies got shut down at some point, at least some of them, not all of them, obviously, but was that kind of like part of, you know, the whole being an independent game developer?
Well, I think it's a part of being a game developer, not even being an independent game developer. I think you if you could talk to anyone who's been doing this for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years and ask them, well, how many of your games have been canceled or changed drastically or things like that? And almost everyone's going to have a story. You know, I mean, everybody out there has canceled games. You know, I mean, every studio and they've canceled more than everybody knows, you know. You can name a studio out there and I'm sure that they've canceled games. So it's just the reality of making games. Sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. And sometimes they move forward, you know, and sometimes they don't for good reasons, sometimes for political reasons, sometimes just because everybody's mad at each other. You know, it's just a lot of reasons why games don't move forward. And it is unfortunate sometimes. I mean, sometimes sometimes there are games out there that should be shot in the head. Just because it's just not working and rather than people put their blood and sweat into it some more to try to make something that's just not going to work, they should be canceled.
I guess it's the same with, with making art pretty much everywhere. I guess pretty much I would assume that most authors, for instance, have a lot of unpublished, half-finished stuff somewhere that just didn't work out.
Yes.
I guess the bad thing about games in that regard is that you can't just, you know, republish it once you got famous and still make $1 million out of it. Speaking about that, the Aliens RPG resulted, if I understood what I researched correctly, from kind of like a time in 2006 when you were approached by three different publishers who wanted to work with you. And I think you said at some point that EA wanted to do an open world game with you. And obviously there must have been a third publisher that I'm not aware of outside of Sega. What got you into developing that Aliens RPG? Because looking back from the modern perspective and from the Skyrims and from the Fallouts and all that type of stuff, the open world game would have seemed like a no-brainer, but obviously at that point it wasn't.
Yeah, no. Well, I think it was a lot of different things. I mean, we were looking at three different games. There was another game, it was actually a game with THQ that we were looking, we actually had contracts on all of them that we were negotiating. And I think the thing that happened, you know, with EA is it just came down to some business terms and there were just some business terms that it was very important to them and they just weren't terms that we could agree to. They're very legal things. So actually it was not money or anything like that. It was just some legal terms that, you know, was, like I said, was important to them. And it was, our lawyer was very adamant and he's rarely been that adamant in the 14 years that we've worked together. So, you know, we respected his opinion and that sort of is kind of how that one was going to move forward. And then Aliens just sounded cool. Like, it's sort of like, you know, why did we do a South Park game? We did a South Park game because it was cool. Like, some people question us sometimes and say, why do you do all this licensed stuff? And I said, well, Matt and Trey called you and said, hey, do you want to make a South Park X? Most people would say, yes, I will make the South Park X, you know, just because you get a chance to work with them and you get to make a cool product. So that's kind of with Aliens. And we could really picture like what we could do with it and how it could sort of continue sort of what we were trying to accomplish in role-playing games with sort of, you know, more in-depth companions and control of those companions. And getting to do something sci-fi sounded fun, something sci-fi again sounded fun too.
Moving back a little bit, doing things backwards for this interview.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's change up your life. before you did, before that time in 2006 as well, you did Neverwinter Nights 2, followed by two add-ons in 07 and 08. And in 2004, you obviously did Knights of the Old Republic, the sequel. How, looking back at those two games, like the early games, the first two games that you made as a studio, how do you look back at them? How important were they for shaping who you are today?
Well, I mean, I think it put us on the map, right? I mean, people knew us from Black Isle, but like, could we do it ourselves? And so KOTOR came out and, you know, as you'd said, there were some criticisms and of that, but as a game, it was an awesome game and it showed we could do awesome things. And Neverwinter Nights 2 let us go back to make a D&D game. And, you know, it let us, you know, it let us put a great group of people together that, you know, a fair number of them are still here today. And so it really helped to solidify us as a studio, but also solidify that this is what we were about. We were about making role-playing games. We were about pushing role-playing games in new directions. We were about, like, the core things of role-playing games: story, characters, companions, and sort of a great game system behind that. So I don't know. I guess that's how I look at them. And as it was, those are the things that sort of springboarded us, and, you know, to be the well-known developer we are today.
I guess what a lot of people don't know, and I was surprised to learn that myself, that you were close to doing a Snow White game at some point.
No, yeah, we were doing a dwarves game with Disney. So we actually worked on it, I want to say probably about a year. Unfortunately that one got canceled, and it was, I think there's a lot of reasons surrounding it. These are not official reasons that I got, but it's, you know, there's some complexities with sort of Disney as a whole was moving from, I can't remember who, Iger to Eisner. Is that right? Yeah. So Disney was moving from Iger to Eisner. And so a lot of things were changing. It found it out later that sort of, at the very high levels of Disney, there was maybe not full approval on using the Snow White license, or Snow White, just, that's not a license, but because they own it, but just using that. And so I just think there's a lot of, there's a lot of things going on there that sort of led to kind of what happened. But it was a really cool game. I mean, you know, Brian Menzies, who's one of our art directors here, who also worked at Black Isle, and he's, you know, if you, for Fallout 2, you're bringing up Fallout 2. Brian is the guy who did all the Vault Boy images for Fallout 2. And he was the kind of the concept artist on that. And his concepts, when I look at it, they're still awesome. And he's like, I just wish we could have finished that one out. So, but yeah, that's kind of what was going on there.
I assume it wasn't a role-playing game, right? I mean, or maybe you were controlling the seven dwarves with Snow White as the hero, but I assume it was a different type of game.
No. So it was not actually Snow White and the seven dwarves. So what it was this idea of in the past, of there was a protagonist, there was a prince-like character that was you, and your companions were sort of the ancestors of the dwarves today, the dwarves of the Snow White time. And the premise of the game was, you know, you kind of go through these, you know, trials and tribulations of the game. And then at the end, the antagonist, you defeat him and you banish him to the mirror. And that was the guy in the mirror, that was the wizard in the mirror, I forget what it's called now. The guy in the mirror in the Snow White story.
Okay, that actually sounds rather cool.
No, yeah, but yeah. Okay.
And now, going even further back, you mentioned your time at Black Isle a couple of times already. I think if I did my research correct, you started there in QA in 1991 when you were 21 years old.
Yeah.
And then you went from being a QA tester to becoming the division director of Black Isle, being responsible for all the role-playing games. And then you obviously, as you mentioned earlier on, you got Fallout put in that category as well. How does one go? I mean, these were obviously the early pioneer days, the golden age and all that stuff, but how does one go from a QA guy to becoming division director at Interplay?
So it was the early days. You're absolutely right. And I think I've explained to people my first interview at Interplay for the QA position is I walked into the VP of operations office, Troy Worrell, Rusty Buchert introduced me and said, hey, you know, he's here for QA. And Troy looked up at me, said, you're Fergus. And I said, yes. He's like, okay. That was my interview. And so it was just a very different time. And, you know, and an awesome time in a lot of ways. And so I worked very hard. Interplay was small. I got to know everybody. And then I came back in 1993 as a producer. And I worked directly for the executive producer, Alan Pavlish. And so I got my own games to work on. I got to work with Mike Morhaime at Blizzard, and I got to work at the Blizzard guys when they were in the early days of making Super Nintendo and Genesis games. And I worked hard. I worked really hard. And I think maybe the other thing is that, to me back then, Brian Fargo was this god. I mean, he was the guy who made Wasteland and Dragon Wars and Bard's Tale and Neuromancer and all this stuff. And so I was always like, when Brian was around, I was like kind of more reserved than maybe I am other times. But whenever Brian would ask me a question, I would give him an answer. I wouldn't kind of like play around. I'm not a person who kisses up. And so I think over time, I mean, Brian just learned to trust, like, even though he didn't like what I was maybe saying from time to time, he learned to trust what I was saying. And I would always, I worked my ass off. And I think I had the right attitude as a producer, which was kind of having an attitude. In that my job is more important than anybody else at certain points in time, because my job is to get a game done and get it out. And I would, this little producer that's just still in college, I would kind of tell VPs who were waiting in line for the copy machine that I needed to make them move away because I needed to copy stuff because I needed to get a bunch of stuff for Nintendo put into a FedEx package so I could get it off because Nintendo needed it the next day. And so I just focused on stuff like that. And I focused on doing things great and working hard and no matter what it was, whether it was a bridge game or a chess game or a platformer or an RPG. And I think that was noticed. And now you also take that time of the industry when there was just, Interplay just needed staff. I mean, they could not hire fast enough to fill the positions that were needed. And you take those two things, and where I may be in the industry nowadays, I would not have been noticed as much, or I would not have gotten as far. I was sort of right place, right time, and I worked hard.
Looking back at these Interplay days, and back then, and I still am today, I was an avid role-playing gamer, and so I played all the old Fallouts. I played, of course, the Baldur's Gates, you had the Icewind Dales. What happened there at the end? It's still kind of baffling with all the stuff that you had going and going into kind of like a new millennium of role-playing games, that it all just fell apart there.
You mean fell apart at Black Isle?
Yeah,
I don't know. I think there was a couple things going on. I mean, obviously I've talked pretty extensively about it, as Brian Fargo has, as just Interplay had a lot of challenges. While Black Isle was making money, Interplay just had made a number of bets that didn't pay off, which all businesses need to make bets. And so, it's sort of understandable, frustrating on my side, but understandable to an extent. I think that Black Isle was also getting caught up in this sort of the realities of sort of 2001, 2002, where the PC was now dying, according to everybody, and the console was the future. And so everybody needed to be on console, and this idea that you were still going to make PC games as a publisher was like insane. It's hard for people to recognize, like more and more people game on their PCs now, but there was that attitude, 15 years ago, that PC was going the way of a dodo as it related to gaming. And we were a very PC focused developer. And I think that was one challenge. We were working with Snowblind on Dark Alliance, and then we did Dark Alliance 2, so we were trying to make that console transition. But I think that we part of Black Isle. What happened with Black Isle was we got caught up in that.
All right, and now here we are, kind of like, I think you left Interplay and Black Isle in 2003, like I said earlier on, and you founded Obsidian, and here we are, like, 15 years later, and you're making these type of games again.
Yes.
Does that feel weird sometimes, or is it kind of like, it feels like fate, or what is it?
Or vindication, I'm not sure. I've always said that I think that these style of games, the Infinity Engine style games, like, they didn't stop being made because people didn't want them anymore. They stopped being made for, I don't even know what the reasons were. It was just because of this console transition and less investment in PC. And then, then game budgets going up really high. So why invest in a game platform that is not where it once was? And so, I am super pleased, because I think we can just do a ton of amazing things within that style of game that are things that, people who love them really enjoy.
Is there something, because I saw again when I did some research on what you're up to, I saw that you're going to be hosting a round table at a developer conference speaking about some of the stuff that went into these old school role-playing games and that might have been the art of storytelling in these type of games and that might have been lost along the way. What is it that you have in mind in that respect?
I'll have to be honest and say I have not thought about it a lot yet. But in general, it's my premise is that, you know, and you see this in movies, like I'll use movies almost as the example. Like, so the Dark Crystal had little to no, I don't know if it had any CG. Like it might, I don't think at all. So the Dark Crystal, an amazing, and they did that. And the movie industry now defaults, like, let's just throw, you know, 172 animators at this scene to make the CG thing, when maybe three people in the creature shop at Jim Henson could have done it pretty much as well, if not better. And my premise is for the roundtable is what are we as game makers doing now, where we are using like hammers that are just way too big to solve simple problems.
Do you have any example in mind, even a hypothetical one?
Well, I think sometimes, you know, and you can actually see this across different games, like some games need that, you know, I'll go weirdly go back to CG. Like sometimes games feel like a lot of people feel like, or a pub, I don't know, just that, like, you, let's throw CG at the problem of storytelling. And is that what players want? Do they want another minute of CG, or do they want that game to react? Can one line of VO that reacts to sort of what a choice or what a player did in the game be more fulfilling to the player than a minute of CG? And that's kind of the thing that is an interesting thing for me to sort of discuss with my peers.
Are you still a role-playing gamer these days? Do you play all the modern RPGs that are out there?
I do. I play a lot. I maybe not as much as I want to, but I try to play as a lot. I'm actually going back through Fallout New Vegas right now, and I'm, you know, I just installed a whole bunch of mods to see what I like and what I don't like. I put, I don't know, 70, 80 hours into Fallout 4. I'm totally can't wait for Andromeda to come out. I played all the Mass Effects. What else am I playing? I played as a Technomancer from Spiderweb. I played that last year as well. I'd like to put some more time into it because I think it's an underrated game. I played all the Gothics. Those haven't been out in many years now. But no, I mean, I try to play as many role-playing games as I can.
Aside from role-playing games, the other thing that has been pretty big for you these last couple of years, obviously, was Armored Warfare. That you worked on for my.com, I think the name is.
Yes.
And but you've recently said, or I read, that you were scaling back on the development on that and leaving more to my.com. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of it. Yeah. So absolutely. I mean, this is kind of working through things with my.com, and mail.ru is their parent company. Yeah. I mean, we've worked on it for a lot. We're really proud of what we've done. And so it, you know, kind of, it's sort of that time in the thing where both my.com also would like to sort of start taking over sort of the development of it, which works great for our schedules. And, you know, we're working together with them to kind of make that the transition to work as good as possible. But like I said, we're really proud of what we've done, and we're really looking forward to see what the my.com team does with the game moving forward.
The reason I bring this up is also because for a period of time, when I looked at what you publicly said in interviews, for instance, you said that Armored Warfare was really big for you. So yeah. in terms of the finances and in terms of what it does for the company, and now that you're scaling back on all that stuff, it's kind of like the natural question would be, okay, what's the other big thing? The new big thing.
The other big thing that I can't talk about.
Okay. Yeah. I totally expected that answer, but yes. I'd be doing a shitty job if I didn't ask.
I may have given you a hint somewhere in this interview about it, but yeah.
Okay, but there is. I mean, you obviously hired some people. I think one of the original people that worked on Fallout, I don't remember his name on top of my head, and I forgot to put it down. Yeah. And I think you already hinted that you still want to make these like $30 or $50 million kind of games, that you're not going to, or you don't want to be the company that just does the Pillars of Eternities and Tyrannies. So is it at least safe to say that we're talking about a big game here in terms of the budget?
There is another game that we are working on.
Okay. I tried. They can't claim I didn't try.
I appreciate the effort.
but not talking about that type of game at all. Just from a, you know, development and vision kind of point of view. I guess what you said and what I found interesting is that you're not going to go and raise like $20 or $30 million for a Pillars of Eternity. Don't you think that, I mean, I'm looking at Star Citizen here, obviously, but that a big kind of like RPG crowdfunded would be able to raise that amount of money, or is that totally out of the question?
I just don't know. Like, I seriously don't have an answer to that question. I mean, I can look at what the most successful video games have done, and I forget what the number is. It's like 6.5 or 9 or something like that. But that, I don't know if that's the ceiling. I mean, what our hope is, particularly with the investment part of FIG, is not only to involve, like I said, the backers, but also investors. And if we can get a series of backers, sorry, of investors that feel like, oh, wow, they performed, I'm getting returns. And we can sort of say, okay, well, instead of asking for $2 million in investment, can we ask for $10 million or $20 million or $30 million and really sort of start making games that way, almost more the way movies get made.
But, you know, naively speaking now, why don't you just give it a shot? I mean, that's the nicest thing about crowdfunding. I mean, if you don't get funded, so no harm done. Or is that too naive? Would you have to do like, you know, put at least a year of work into that in order to credibly, you know, be at that stage where you could even go to a crowdfunding platform? Or is that a feasible way?
Yeah, no, I think the thing is, I think nowadays people want to see more when you're going to go, you know, going to kind of put up your crowdfunding. So we'd have to put a fair amount of effort into it. We really need to be able to show things, you know, and to be honest, I mean, here's the challenge. Like, so it's interesting. Like, I can get a feeling for a game that I feel is going to be successful. Like, I feel really good about it, and I think I can sell it. And I think when it comes out, people are going to really enjoy it. Crowdfunding, I think, sometimes can be a little bit, potentially could be a little bit fickle. I don't know that. I just, maybe it's even the wrong way to say it. But I think sometimes there's a feeling, you know, from a lot of us, like that if we were to go up with an idea, and I have the total counter argument to this as well, that I'll give you right after, but that you go up with an idea, and if not enough people, like, let's say you get funded, but you're not really funded that much, maybe does that hurt you? Does it, like, well, because people can say, well, you know, their last thing got 4 million and this one only got 1.5 million. This new thing must not be good. And so it's sort of like, that's kind of worry. That's a little bit of a worrisome. Now, and the counter argument being that, let's say you go up with a new idea and a new thing and all that kind of stuff, and, you know, and let's say it doesn't get funded. Well, maybe really your idea wasn't good and it was good to learn that. And so I don't know. That's the crowdfunding thing is a very, even us having now done it twice and, well, third time with the board game that I did with some friends. But it's just a weird thing. And I don't know how to approach the bigger games.
So it's in that regard, it's still safer to work with a publisher, even if there's something broken in that system, as we touched upon earlier in the interview.
I think so. I mean, it's all dependent upon what you want to make. Like, if you want to go make a $50 million game and you're not independently wealthy and you don't have a group of friends that will give you $5 million each, video games are still sort of a very new thing when it comes to sort of outside investment. So really your option is a publisher. I mean, that's, I think, you know, for right now, hopefully that will change, but for those bigger games, that's really kind of where that funding is going to come from.
Last question from one player of role-playing games to another, and you probably played more than I did, but I'd be interested in your favorite role-playing game and in the one you consider to be the most criminally underrated one.
Okay, geez. It's so hard. I just have to go back. The one that I think the solidified my love of role-playing games was probably Ultima 4. Because that was this world, there was people to talk to, there was sort of like multiple parts to the story that you had to get through. There was the stones and the dungeons and I still have on my shelf, I have my notebook of where I took all those things. So I think that, you know, that was, you know, Ultima 4 was really my, I'll go with that. It's criminally underrated. Oh, wow. I really like Two Worlds. I understand that the people's, you know, like criticisms of its flaws, but I really, there was like a lot of mechanisms in Two Worlds that I liked a lot. And what else? I'm sorry, I'd have to think about that longer.
Nope.
You just won the question that I don't think I've been asked in an interview. So I would have to really think about it some more and go through. I
do admit I was probably just fishing for something that even I hadn't heard of, and I can go like, oh, I've never heard of this game. Now I've got something to play. And I do love the Ultima 4 answer, by the way, because recently I had a talk with one of our backers, because we're also crowdfunded with our podcast that we're doing. And we were talking about old role-playing games. I'm a huge Ultima fan, and he was arguing that these weren't particularly good games, looking back and all that type of stuff. And I was saying that I think that you won't find a whole lot of modern role-playing game designers who won't cite Ultima 4 as one of the most important role-playing games of all times. And now you just reinforced that, and I love it.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah. All right, Fergus. Thank you very, very much for taking the time to do this interview. I think that about covers it from my end. And I hope we hear about your next secret game soon. Can't wait for it. I'm not trying to fish for any more information.
I understand. Yeah, and you can fish all you want. So.
I'm not very good at fishing. I only did it once and caught a turtle.
Oh, there was. You got something.
Caught a turtle. So, yeah. But yeah, again, thank you very much for your time. And I'm really looking forward to the next games and to Pillars of Eternity 2, obviously. Ladies and gentlemen, that was it for Well Played for this month. I hope you enjoyed the interview as much as I enjoyed doing it. Thank you again for being backers of our podcast. We're gonna be back next month with a new interview. Take care.